Imagine a world where this bottle of water could power your house for 3 days. That's the future we're gunning for at Nearstar Fusion.
Your trusted source for information on the energy transition. This is the Insider's Guide to Energy Podcast.
Why don't you help me understand what Nearstar Fusion's doing?
Here at Nearstar, we're building the future of fusion power plants using hypervelocity plasma railguns.
So that's a mouthful. Help me understand, first off, what is a hypervelocity railgun? That sounds dangerous.
It might sound dangerous, but it's actually quite safe. Railguns, a lot of people know them from the military, but those are what are called solid armature railguns. Those are different than what we're talking about here. A plasma armature railgun is one where we're using plasma to accelerate the projectile. In our case, it's a 50-gram projectile like this. And when I say hypervelocity, we're talking speeds of 10 kilometers per second or 6 miles per second, which is roughly 30 times the speed of sound.
All right. And so you're taking a projectile, and I assume you're shooting it into something to make fusion?
That's right. So we're shooting it into what we call a fuel target, which would be roughly the size of a golf ball. And inside of this is an isotope of hydrogen called deuterium. So our approach uses what's called deuterium-deuterium. And what we want to do is combine those two hydrogen atoms, create some helium, but more importantly, create lots of energy. And the way we do that is we have that fuel target, which is impacted by this projectile at that hypervelocity. And we add a little magic sauce of a magnetic field around the target. And then the combination of that magnetic field and that impact creates fusion conditions, which creates a miniature fusion bomb.
Wow. Okay, so how do you contain that fusion? How do you keep it in there? So you've just shot something at a high rate of speed into something, got some sort of a chain reaction or reaction to take place. So how do you contain it and capture the energy?
So the great thing about fusion is that it doesn't chain react. So it makes it inherently safe. Yeah. And we're using just a very little bit of fuel, very, very small. And so what happens is when that energy is released out of that fusion implosion, we have what's called a molten salt, which is a chemical that's very good at absorbing heat. And so that energy that's released out of that fusion implosion is captured by that molten salt and then pumped through a heat exchanger to go boil water. And then that's the steam from that water turns a turbine and puts clean energy on the power grid.
Okay, so I've got the general picture. To continually generate energy, wouldn't you have to shoot a lot of these things?
Absolutely. So we would shoot these roughly once per second. So that's called 1 hertz. And so you can imagine a single power plant would shoot roughly 35 million shots per year. So, yes.
Now, fusion's been around for a long time. What are some of the other methods that someone might use to make fusion? Like, how does this differ than some of the other efforts going on to generate fusion?
Yeah, in the world of fusion, there are primarily two camps of approaches. One is called magnetic confinement, and the other is called inertial confinement. In magnetic confinement, you're trying to keep plasma alive like a little miniature sun 24/7. That's called steady state plasma, and that's incredibly difficult to do. But when you hear of designs like a tokamak or a stellarator, that's essentially what they're doing there. On the other side of the spectrum is called inertial confinement, which is basically doing it in pulses in some iteration. In our case, it's happening once a second, but in other approaches, they're trying to do it maybe 10 times a second. So often when you hear things like laser fusion, they're doing inertial confinement. And today, you might have heard of the NIF success that happened about a year and a half ago, where they actually were able to get more energy out than they were able to put in using inertial confinement. What's unique about Nearstar is that we're actually trying to take the best of both worlds. Not only are we doing the inertial confinement with the impact with these projectiles, but we're also putting a magnetic field on the fuel target so we get the benefits that the magnetic approach has as well. So we believe that by combining the best of both worlds, that we can achieve fusion faster than our friends in the fusion industry.
Now, NearStar, I'm sitting in a facility that's been here for 10 years. So you guys have been working on this problem for a while. What aha moments have accelerated this to make me think that we're closer to this than we were 10 years ago when you started?
Well, there'll be a number of things. One is impact fusion is nothing new. It's that the concept has been around for quite some time, roughly 50 years or so. But what really changed is that in the previous research, the impact fusion required something to be accelerated at 200 kilometers per second, which is just not achievable even with the technology that we have today. But what was discovered is that if you actually magnetize the target, the amount of kinetic energy you need to initiate that fusion interaction goes down by a magnitude or more. So that put it into the realm of the technology that we are experts at, which is building these plasma guns. You couple that with the advances in compute technology, so the ability to do computer models instead of weeks or months, you can literally do computer models in a matter of days and potentially in hours. It changes the iteration changes the speed of your learning. And we've learned so much more in the last 10 years. And that's why this approach is now becoming viable.
So to make the kind of reactors or system that you're making, you started the show by talking about getting a lot of power from something the size of a water bottle. Mm-hmm. How big are these things?
So in our design, the physical footprint of a power plant would be pretty long and skinny. So think about the length of a football field, but maybe as wide as like two or three conference rooms. So, and each instance of that would be roughly a 50 to 100 megawatt reactor. And so what's nice about that is if you wanted to serve a community that needed 200 or 300 megawatts, you could easily put them in parallel next to each other on the ground and service what right size the power plant to the energy needs of that market.
How quickly can you spin up baseload up and down based on this architecture? Is it different or is it pretty consistent in the power? Like, can you ramp up very quickly to get the power?
We believe so. I mean, time will tell as we start building out the actual prototype plant and whatnot, but the parasitic energy requirements for our design are relatively low compared to alternative approaches. So we're quite optimistic that we'll be able to get that up and running faster.
All right. So we're talking a lot of futures. I hear a lot of futures. I've seen a lot of cool stuff sitting around the building they're in. Where are we at today and where are we going and in how long?
Well, I always want to let people know fusion is hard, right? There's a lot, there's the engineering risk, but more importantly, there's the physics risk. So no one should be telling you that it's going to happen next year. This is a 5 to 10 year process at a minimum. Where we are now is we're still early stage. We have our computer models that are proving or showing us that we can achieve what we want to achieve. But we need to run live experiments, and that's what we hope to do later this year. We're actually going to rent a ballistic testing facility to do some of our live experiments. And at that point, we will have a much better idea of is the physics that we are designing going to work or not going to work? And from there, we can, we'll have a few more physics to de-risk, but the first hurdle of doing some single-shot experiments on prototype targets is a big one for us to really get moving.
So are we still in the science phase where things are more peer reviewed, or are we at the commercialization phase where we kind of keep stuff to ourselves to try to get competitive advantage? Where are we in fusion?
Both, if that's a valid answer. There are roughly 45 private fusion companies worldwide. That doesn't include entities out of China. And so we always have to kind of keep our secret sauce to ourselves. At the same time, investors are owed, honest information that, they don't always have the ability to technically do the due diligence required. So putting out research that is peer reviewed is necessary to kind of build that confidence in the investor community. So we have to do both. We have to share results, but we also have to keep some of our secret sauce to ourselves.
So is it mostly physicists then you employ?
At the current time, it's mostly physicists, but as we grow, we're going to need mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, computer mathematicians. We're going to need a whole cadre of staff to do everything that we need to do eventually.
So in our pre-conversation before the interview, we talked a little bit about supply chain and things like that. Help me understand, does a solution like yours change our supply chain demand, or how do we scale this up? If we're going to really fight global climate change and things like that, if that's one of your reasons for doing this, what kind of supply chain do you envision when these things become a reality?
Well, first off, by using deuterium fuel, that's available in every body of water around the world. So as far as the source of fuel is concerned, we don't need to go to any foreign entity to get the fuel, which is really, really nice. Our design, other than that, uses mostly COTS materials, things that are readily available, electrolytic capacitors, solid state switches, things that, you know, often are made abroad, but can also be near shored as well as needed. So we feel very confident that all the technology and the materials that we need to build our power plant are readily available in North America, which provides us a much stronger ability to deliver energy independence as well as energy security.
How big a role do the national labs play in fusion development?
A huge role. I mean, without them, so much of the risky physics would not get researched and de-risked. They're critical to the solution at the end. Like I said, there are many different approaches, and you know, we would love if the national labs had more funding to experiment with alternative methods as well.
What's the biggest risk for a technology like the one you're describing?
So the biggest risk is actually making fusion happen in a consistent manner, right? And so, you know, fusion does, by its very nature, does not want to happen. Two atoms do not want to join together and make a new atom. You know, fusion is what they say powers, you know, is what powers the sun. But the sun has a major advantage over the Earth because the gravity on the sun is 28 times more than what we have here. So to compensate for that, you have to get, to create fusion conditions here, you have to get to temperatures of 100 million degrees centigrade, which is pretty hot, right? And so making that happen on a consistent method is really, really hard. So the physics risk around doing that over and over and over again without the power plant falling apart or, you know, overheating or whatnot, that's incredibly difficult. And that's what most companies are working towards. Humans know how to do fusion. We've been doing that for, you know, over 70 years. But doing it in a controlled manner, that's what's really hard.
All right. And so the risk is containment, heat, longevity, all of the above?
All of the above. So there's most fusion scientists will talk about something called the triple product, or also known as the Lawson criteria, which is a combination of time, temperature, and density. And so you have to get enough of these hydrogen atoms close enough together for a long enough time to make that fusion happen. Without that, fusion doesn't want to happen. It's just, you just get nothing happens. So making that is incredibly difficult, and there are different approaches. Some are using superconducting magnets to force those hydrogen atoms together. Others are using high-powered lasers to compress fuel targets. We just happen to be using our hypervelocity plasma railgun and magnetized fuel targets, which we think is the fastest way to get there.
So today there's a lot of talk about doing solar, long-term storage, and wind. Mm-hmm. Is that a distraction and are funds getting diverted from going to fusion, or do you think we should do that first to buy the time to get to fusion?
I think we have to have multiple tools in our toolbox to solve the energy crisis. Solar and wind are great technologies, but they're both geographically dependent, as well as classic nuclear fission is also. I mean, a lot of people don't want a fission power plant in their backyard. So most of the renewable, or all the renewables today, are geographically constrained. Fusion energy is the one possible energy source that is not geographically constrained and can also be used in space. So it has amazing potential to provide energy all around the world, including space exploration.
Fusion's had a few false starts before, or perceived false starts. Are you finding that makes it hard to get investors and folks interested in following Fusion today?
As far as investors are concerned, getting them to come on board, a lot of it requires education of what is Fusion, what is the timeline, what is the payoff, and that takes effort. But once they understand that, they seem more inclined. Then the job becomes, there's so many approaches out there, which approach is going to be the most likely to succeed? Because even the companies that have billions of dollars of funding, they haven't cracked the code yet. And I don't think anyone who's well-versed in fusion would say that definitely this one solution is the way. No one actually knows which solution is going to work in the end.
So do you believe that a number of companies will crack the code and will have several solutions come to life about the same time?
My personal belief is that there'll probably be two or three different solutions that will crack the code, and they will have different levels of commercial viability depending on what type of market they're serving. Some of the designs are more geared towards very large energy markets on the gigawatt scales, whereas others are geared towards very small markets, even micro markets. So I think we'll have winners in different sized markets. And so I think there'll be two to three eventually, probably all in the next 5 to 10 years.
And is there a public perception that this is like nuclear energy and dangerous, or is the perception that it's not? So you talked about having these in, you know, high populated areas and mm-hmm. things like that. Why does that make sense?
Well, public perception has changed greatly over the last couple of years. People hear the word nuclear and they automatically think of the fission reactors, things like Chernobyl and Three Mile Island and Fukushima. But I think there's been a great campaign to not only improve the image of just nuclear fission, but along with it, that people have a very favorable view of fusion once they get to know it. And so much so that even the USNRC last year ruled that they were going to regulate fusion under Part 30, which is essentially like regulating it like as nuclear medicine, similar to an MRI machine in the hospital that could be a block away from your house. So the perception of fusion has improved, and mostly because it is so safe. As I mentioned earlier, fusion doesn't want to chain react. So even if something went terribly wrong at a fusion power plant, it would just shut down and nothing would happen.
So I was taught if it sounds too good to be true, it can't be. So what are some of the realities that we should be thinking about, you know, that are out there? Because it can't all be amazing.
Sure. And they often call fusion the holy grail of energy, and for good reason. I think as far as some of the caveats to fusion, most approaches use a isotope of hydrogen called tritium, which is actually quite expensive and slightly radioactive, not nearly as radioactive as uranium or plutonium, but it does come with some overhead required to make that, to handle it and regulate it and whatnot. But the other, I think, issue that people have to understand is that we're trying to make consistent fusion happen, but then there's the second problem of making it economically viable. So going back to the NIF experiment, for example, they got roughly 50% more energy out than they put in. But to make a commercially viable power plant, you have to get roughly 20 times more energy out than you get in. So, and that's from what we call the wall plug, not just the scientific gain. There's actual economic gain that you have to think about. So that secondary engineering problem and economic hurdle is a real one, and one that it will be difficult for some designs to achieve in the long run.
Is that the next big milestone that we're hoping to see, or what's the next milestone for fusion?
I think the next major milestone is to get to where the NIF was, get to that ignition event where you're getting more energy out than you're putting in, and then increasing the gain to 20 to 100 or whatever the design requires, and making that happen at scale. So there's still a lot a lot of ways to go to commercialize it.
What about NearStar's design and architecture makes you think that you're on that track?
Well, for starters, we always built this this design to be a power plant first and a science experiment second. So inherent in our design is all the thought of how do we build this at a very economic scale using, you know, things that are available today, electrolytic capacitors, solid state switches, things like that, so that when we finally do solve the physics problems, that now we're not cornered into a box where we can't make it economically viable because the materials don't exist or we can't get them at scale and it's difficult to assemble. So, you know, we made it so that it's easy to maintain, it would be highly available, and operating it would be simplified as well.
Now, if I took this concept the way you just talked about it, the accelerating process, and go through that and take it to some of the mainstream fusion companies, will they think I'm a little bit nutty about this, or are they curious about what you guys are doing?
Generally, they've shown a lot of curiosity. They think it's an interesting idea. They want to see the published research like so many of their investors do. And I think the onus is on us to get them that information.
And is that why you guys are kind of coming out of stealth mode right now and starting to talk about it?
Yeah. We were in stealth mode for a while, but we realized we are unique in what we can do with the railgun, and that we have to kind of expose some of our design so that people understand and don't just give us money on a leap of faith, but actually believe in what we're doing and know that we'll succeed.
I always like to end these interviews with a crystal ball question. And we're talking fusion, so I can't do the usual 12 months from now.
No.
So in the next 5 years, where is your organization and what do you guys have achieved?
I think our organization is in a much bigger facility. I think we'll have not only physicists working here, but lots of engineers working on building experiments that are increasing our gain. So hopefully we're at that point, we are not only getting energy gain, but we're trying to improve the gain so we can get to 20, 40, 100 gain so that we can make it even more profitable for a commercial entity. And we're having serious conversations with potential partners who want to build our power plants in the future. And that isn't just limited to traditional power plant companies today, but even potentially automobile companies that can retool their factories to make the components of our power plant en masse around the world.
So you believe that electrification is the end game, the long-term game?
It is. I believe it is. I mean, hydrocarbons are here for a while for sure, but that's just going to be an intermediary to get to electrification. And I mean, cars, industry, everything is moving in that direction, and it's the way of the future.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank you so much for inviting us to your facility today and sharing us. It's been a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.